Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, and today we have on the show with us, once again, Dr. Doug Axe, the director of the Biologic Institute, to talk about his new paper, The Limits of Complex Adaptation, an analysis based on a simple model of structured bacterial populations, published in the journal Biocomplexity. So, Dr. Axe, thanks for coming back on the show with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Axe, before we get back into some of the technical aspects of your paper, I'd like to just ask you the question, what got you interested in this kind of research about population genetics and bacteria, and why do you feel it's important to the debate over neo-Darwinian evolution and intelligent design?
Well, my colleagues and I have been very interested in doing experimental work and modeling work on enzymes. So we go to the lab and we're asking what it takes for an enzyme to work, what you need for the amino acid sequence to be appropriate, and what you need to convert an enzyme that performs one function into another function. And so this is something that we've done a lot of work on in the lab, and we've come up with some answers, but the answers need interpretation. So, for example, a recent study that we hope will be published fairly soon was looking at how many changes to a gene are needed to achieve a particular enzyme conversion, and we got a number, but at the end of the day, you don't really want a number. You want to say, is this feasible or not, given the number? And what you need to do really is combine the experimental result, which gives you this number of mutations, with some sort of analysis, a realistic analysis that says, okay, if that's how many you need, how long would it take to get that in a realistic population? And so that's really the motivation behind doing the population genetics work. It's to give you a realistic mathematical framework for interpreting what we're finding out in the lab.
Now, your results found that complex adaptational features that require two or more maladaptive mutations or six or more neutral mutations would be unlikely to arise in the history of the Earth. Is it likely that these kinds of structures or these kinds of complex features actually exist? And if so, can you maybe give us a little bit of an understanding of some examples of those kinds of features?
Okay, that's a good question, because this is basically the question of how relevant are these analyses to what we know about biology. I would say that some of the most interesting innovations, so remember when we're talking about innovations, we're talking about things that perform a new function or give their possessor a new ability. The vast majority, from what we can tell from real biology, of innovations would require many more than six nucleotide substitutions. So, for example, from my own work, I've been interested in the origin of entirely new protein folds. So that would be proteins that have a three-dimensional structure that's substantially different from any of the pre-existing proteins in the organism. And it's just a plain matter of fact that to get to a new fold, if we're talking about folds that are of normal size, so these would be hundreds of amino acid residues, 150 to 200 perhaps would be fairly typical for a domain-sized fold. To jump from one fold to another, you would need to make many more than six nucleotide substitutions, typically. So that would be an example of getting something new that appears to be well beyond the reach of Darwinian evolution, even if you assume that the intermediates are neutral. Of course, if the intermediates are even slightly detrimental, maladaptive, then you don't even get six. You're allowed to make two changes, in which case it appears to be virtually impossible that you would get something like a new protein fold. But there's a smaller kind of innovation that we're interested in, and that is whether it's possible to get new functions from existing protein folds. And the way this is thought to happen is a gene that encodes a working protein, an enzyme, say, becomes duplicated just by a chance event in the chromosome that causes a chunk of the chromosome to be duplicated and kept in the genome. That gives the organism a spare copy of one or more genes. So it no longer needs these spares, it could get rid of them, or mutations could happen that slightly change the amino acid sequence in these spare copies. And it's thought that when that happens, when mutations start to change these spare copies, occasionally they stumble upon a new beneficial function. So there's been a great deal of interest in validating that idea in the lab. And so a number of people, including our team at Biologic Institute, have gone to the lab and have tried to convert enzymes from one function to a new function by changing their amino acid sequences. And the idea is to achieve that kind of conversion with as few changes as possible. Now, there is one or a few cases where someone appears to have achieved a conversion to a new function with just one nucleotide substitution, but if you survey all the literature on this, you see that that is very much the exception and not the rule. The rule is that very many substitutions, nucleotide changes, typically well over six, are needed to get even weak conversion to a new function. So if you look at all of the literature on this, it appears that in many cases, even this simple task of converting an existing protein fold to a new function may well be beyond the six base limit and is clearly beyond the two base limit if any of the intermediates are maladaptive.
Well, Dr. Axe, you keep answering my next question before I have a chance to ask it.
I didn't mean to do that.
I think that the answer to this next question is very clear. I mean, if so many of these features that we see in biology at the molecular level, protein folds, basic structures, basic functions, would require, you know, two or more, or six or more mutations to function, I was going to ask you, what are the overall implications of this research? But it seems pretty clear to me that something other than unguided neo-Darwinian evolution has to be at work to produce these features. Is that incorrect?
No, I think that's correct. And what really compounds this is the reality that if you look at what we would call innovations, systems that perform new functions in life, even in the simplest life, so even in bacterial life, you would typically be looking not at a single gene that performs a new function, but a suite of genes that work together. So a metabolic pathway, for example, might be encoded by four, five, or six genes, each of which encodes an enzyme, and each of these enzymes has a new function relative to the rest of the genome. So these are, in other words, to get a new metabolic pathway, to get new chemistry in life, you typically would need to get not just one gene with a new function, but several. And what that does to the probabilities is it multiplies them. So if the waiting time for getting a conversion of a single gene to a new function is extraordinarily long, say it would require billions of years, the waiting time to get two, you're basically going to have to square the waiting time. And to get three, you're going to have to raise the waiting time to the power three. So things become very, very bad very quickly when you take that into account. It's that exponential growth in how bad things get that the Lynch and Abeg paper was suggesting that they had removed, that at least in the neutral case, they were saying, it doesn't matter how many mutations you need to make this new innovation appear. If the intermediates en route to the innovation are neutral, the waiting time will be as though it was just one mutation. And when I read that, I didn't believe it, but I had to dig through the math to find out how they got that, and I still don't believe it.
I have one last question for you, Dr. Axe, and that is, do you really exist? Because I hear all the time that ID proponents do not do research. Judge Jones told me, and he's a federal judge, by the way, you know, he told me in five places in the Dover ruling that ID proponents do not do research, and yet supposedly you are the director of a research lab that looks at issues related to intelligent design. So, I mean, my very simple question is, do you actually exist?
I certainly believe I do, but, you know, it's very hard to prove that kind of thing. What I would say, actually, is Judge Jones, I've never met the guy, but he may have been operating on old material that was fed to him by someone else. Now that position is no longer tenable, and biocomplexity, in my mind, is going to make that abundantly obvious. If anyone wants to look to see whether there's research, go to Biocomplexity and you'll see it there.
Well, Dr. X, we really appreciate your time. We know you're very busy and doing a lot of work. So thank you for taking the time to explain to our listeners about the latest paper you published, and we just wish you the best in your further work.
Okay. Thank you, Casey.
I'm Casey Leskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.